Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. A lot of news, both a mix of national, state, and some local news to talk about on the show today. And to do that, we have my colleague Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. As I often say, you read him on Wednesdays and Sundays in the the paper edition,
right.
The dead tree edition, as I call it, of the AJC. And then he oversees the Political Insider blog, which is part of Politically Georgia,
right.
On the MyAJC website.
It's like a
it's like a Russian doll.
Yeah, there we go.
Mr. Galloway, you have a guest with you at
do.
Political Rewind. Would you like to introduce her?
This is my daughter, Emily. She is an employee of FEMA. And she's doing an excellent job. Donald Trump says so.
Georgia Southern, Harrison High School in Cobb County, played in the marching band, I learned this afternoon.
That's right. Yeah, you really grilled her.
And went to Georgia Southern, where she was a geography major.
Right.
And I said, well, I didn't think you could be a major in geography. I thought that was just a subject you took within a major.
You know all this computer mapping that they do now? That's geography.
Well, we're glad to have Emily here. It's really fun to have your daughter in here with us. We hear about her a lot when we're not on the air, when we're talking with each other as friends. Also here today, I think the most popular former member of the United States Congress on this show, former Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden of Cobb County. Hi.
It's good to be here. The operative word is former.
Boy, you know, I'll bet you are awfully glad when you look at what goes on up there these days that you can call yourself a former member of Congress.
Well, I had an excellent run there, and I'm proud to have served, but it's time for somebody else to do the job.
Well, okay, buddy. Thank you for being here. And we're welcoming back to the Political Rewind studio Republican strategist Leo Smith. Leo, we couldn't have you on for a while because you were a candidate for office, and we're glad you're back, but we're sorry because we like you personally that the race didn't go the way you wanted.
Oh, I would have voted. Well, I would have voted for
that.
You. I would have voted.
Tell everybody
for
what
you
ran for.
I ran for the state senator for District 6,
gotcha.
A Senate District 6 for Georgia, and I've learned a lot by being on the other side of that of the table.
But to your credit, every other Republican in that race lost, too.
That's right.
You know, I probably had the most efficient campaign. Some people spent hundreds of thousands. I spent a couple of tens, and we had the same result.
All right. Well, Leo, we're glad you're available to be back with us on Political Rewind. Breaking news, a couple of hours ago, President Trump signed the tax bill. He was planning on doing it next week. But wanted to get it done as quickly as possible. Let's listen to what he said about all that.
So I'll sign this today rather than having a very big formal ceremony in 2 weeks when we were going to do it, because I didn't want you folks to say that I wasn't keeping my promise. I am keeping my promise. I am signing it before Christmas. I said that the bill would be on my desk before Christmas, and you are holding me literally to that. So we did a rush job today. It's not fancy, but it's the Oval Office. It's the great Oval Office.
What he's referring to, Jim, is the fact that they needed to get the spending bill out of the way, the extension of the government spending out of the way, and then he could turn to this. They weren't sure they could get that done as quickly as they did, but Congress passed that yesterday and opened the door for the president to sign the bill today without the usual kind of ceremonial flourishes, the ceremonial pats on the back, which are now required of any bill signing with President Trump.
Oh, it was a big. I think they filled a couple staircases.
Yeah, the other day passage.
Yeah. And now we just sit back and we wait and learn what people really think about
it. Yeah, you know, you have to say, Leo, that the optics in the initial aftermath of this signing for Republicans are really quite good. They got the bill done, first of all, the first major piece of legislation they've been able to get through the Congress. Second of all, it is, despite much controversy over what the bill will do in the long run, it does appear that many, many Americans will get at least a temporary tax cut. we'll see how that plays out in the long run. It works better for people over 75,000 than under 75,000 and up. But that's not a bad thing for Republicans to talk about. And we also have a number of companies today, AT&T leading the way, saying they're going to make a huge investment now in, you know, building infrastructure in the United States, are going to give bonuses.
So and they're laying off people.
Well, too. You know, but
it's fully tax deductible what they're doing.
Wait.
Well, $1,000, you know, gift to people from AT&T is really, look, investor confidence is up. Confidence is very sexy. They're going to ride this all the way through making sure that Democrats have nothing that can actually penetrate this winning that's going on.
Well, the reality is, I mean, first of all, look, I do believe we have to give credit to the Republicans to say the optics of this right now, buddy Darden, are fairly good for them. That doesn't mean, I think what Leo suggests may be worth contemplating. We'll see how this feels 6 months down the road, I think. But for today, it does seem like a victory for Trump and the Republicans, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. They're fawning all over him, and which seems to be the new mode in Washington. But I would point out that it is $1.5 trillion deficit additional to the deficit that's coming out of this, and somebody's going to have to pay the piper one day, and a good conservative like Leo has got to be very, very concerned about
it. I'm concerned, but, you know, my number one reason for supporting President Trump when he was a candidate, Trump, was because of the economic disruption I thought we needed. And so we have to ask ourselves, I sat right here and said, gosh, I can't imagine that guy winning, but he's been so different. And so a lot of people are saying, I can't imagine that we'll keep this 3% revenue growth going. Well, he's surprised us once. I think he might surprise us again with his revenue growth.
You know, smoking, boy, I really, you know, smoking may kill you in the long run, but I really love the way that cigarette tastes today. I mean, my point being that we'll see how this all plays out.
AT&T is promising bonuses.
Yeah.
Notice the bonuses. They're promising bonuses. They're not promising wage hikes.
Right.
which are very different. And, you know, that's anecdotal. We'll see what corporations do as a group.
But the real crumbs,
whether they pass those whether trickle down actually works, because that's what this is. This is trickle down.
Jim, these are little crumbs they're throwing out there, but the big deal is for General Motors and Georgia Power.
Right.
And Shell Oil Company, and all those are getting the real tax breaks without having to give up any deductions.
We're just starting here. I mean, so Wells Fargo and some of the banks have increased the wage hikes because of this. And so let's give those other companies chances to enjoy the Trump fall.
Wells Fargo, the number one corporate criminal in America.
there's no question that one of the reasons this bill has been so unpopular with the American people based on all of the polling is what you're saying, buddy. It's no secret that it's big, big corporations and the wealthiest Americans who are going to make out like bandits. And when we hear the president repeat over and over again, despite understanding the truth about this, that he's going to take a hit, this is not good for him. There is a specific provision in this measure that they passed, which is going to be a windfall for developers like Donald Trump.
Absolutely, and I'm not sure that he doesn't realize that people just don't believe him anymore anyway, so he can just say whatever he wants to do and people discount it. But he is a big beneficiary, not only on the real estate development area, but also he has doubled the amount of money that he can leave to his heirs.
Right.
I mean,
it's important to remember that he promised a big infrastructure package for America. Part of that is to give the developers the confidence to go ahead and start helping to redevelop America, to build more. And that's what this plan also stimulates.
Bill, I think what we got, if the parallels to the ACA passage are kind of interesting. Number one, they both were passed highly charged, highly partisan fashion. No real participation by the other party. The ACA came out highly demonized, but in the end, you know, after the demonization, people got used to it, and it's been hard to pull it away. I mean, that's what they had to sneak through the end of this mandate into the tax reform bill in order to pass it.
Right.
And I think it's very possible, in my mind, that this could have the same, that this tax rewrite, I'm not calling it tax reform because it's far, far from that, but this tax rewrite could have the same effect.
Did you see where ACA now, the number of people signing up has doubled within the last week, and the time has been extended up until January the 15th with no advertising, with no publicity? People in Georgia are flocking to the ACA.
Yeah, we're talking specifically about what Buddy's saying. Jim, you and I discussed this. There are like 500,000 new signups.
Right.
And with the extension here in Georgia, we could end up eclipsing how many people enrolled last year.
Right, right. 492,000 enrolled last year. We're up to, I think, something in the 480s right now. And because of Hurricane Irma, the signup period has been extended to January 31st. So you could easily pass 500,000, I think.
I want to point out one distinction, though, that Jim, I don't think, intentionally left out, but we need to point the difference between ACA and, of course, the so-called tax reform. And that is, the ACA was done over a period of a year. There were hearings. It was studied and restudied and criticized and recriticized, but it was done totally out in the open. Whereas this bill was done in the dark of night with no hearing,
and the only but there are other differences too. Number one is the ACA gave individuals something very concrete to hang on to with the end of pre-existing conditions, and millions and millions of people suddenly were eligible for health insurance that they could never be eligible for before. Now, the question is, when I file my taxes on April 15th,
yeah,
am I going to notice it?
No.
Going to say,
well, you won't this year.
Well, but you're planning your taxes now, and you can talk to your CPA and see what you're going to get.
Well, wait, be careful, because we need to make this clear, because there was some confusion coming out of Washington on this. This bill will not really take effect. We're not going to feel this until you're working on returns for the year 2018. You're not going to see much in 2017.
And that's my point, is that you're not going to, the real dollar impact is not going to be felt by American voters until after the 2018 elections.
Right. So, well, which could be good for each side. You know, depends on how you spin it. So, Leo, let me just get to the political question here. Do you really think Republicans are going to have, you kind of hinted at this or said it, basically. You see this bill as being something Republican candidates will be able to run proudly on in 2018, congressional Republicans?
Yes, and I give you a stark contrast to help out with this. With the ACA, some people lost. Quite a few people lost with the passing of the Affordable Care Act. With this particular bill, everybody wins.
Unless you're in under $75,000.
Yeah.
All right.
That's not everybody.
But how do you lose with ACA?
I don't know how you lost with ACA.
Well, you're not going to go. Even people under $75,000 are not going to be taxed more than they were taxed with Obama's tax legislation.
But how are people losing with ACA? I thought everybody gained, especially with the pre-existing conditions.
If you were young in the prime of your working working career, you're paying more with ACA.
All right, let me not. I don't want to relitigate the Affordable Care Act. That's old news right now. But I do want to ask this, Buddy, and then I want to move on. You know, it's interesting what you just said a little while ago about the president. Does he even care anymore whether people believe him or not? He just says, you know, the president continues to say that this is the largest tax cut in American history. It's a bad statement to make. We can go back just to the 80s and see five tax cuts, including the Reagan tax cut of 81, which was the biggest of them all, that were bigger than what he has passed now. Why the need, having done something that, as I believe right now, the optics look good for them, why blow this out of proportion and have people coming after you for that?
He can't help it. He is a serial misrepresenter. and he cannot tell the truth. And it just doesn't come naturally for him. And he's been on television and done all these. He's the P.T. Barnum of the current day.
All right. Okay. So the tax cut is now law. People are going to rush to their accountants to figure out what it's going to mean in the long run. But it's going to be a while before individuals see much of an impact on this, except as it relates to your workplace. It is also true, and I don't want to be accused of not including this, it is also true that withholdings from paychecks will be impacted by this. So you won't see this when you file income tax in 18, but you will start seeing some impact from the withholdings on your paycheck.
As early as February,
right.
Possibly.
Okay. All right. Jim Galloway, we devoted a good portion of the show on Wednesday to a conversation about the vote that the Public Service Commission took yesterday on whether or not Plant Vogtle should be able to expand build the two new towers to their nuclear facility out there at Augusta. And Tim Echols came on the show and made the case for the good and the bad of that. Well, of course, to no one's great surprise, yesterday the PSC said, go ahead. It accepted the charges that Georgia Power said it was going to have to make, the cost that this was going to have to be approved by PSC. And unanimously, the PSC said,
5-0 vote. Yep.
Go ahead. What's the impact on customers?
Well, the impact on customers is that, number one, you're going to continue to pay in advance for the construction of Vogtle, as far as the financing portion of the bill comes. And once it goes online, your bill is going to go up another 5%.
So it's a total 10%. As you pointed out, we've been paying 5% already, thanks to the a bill passed by the legislature
in 2009,
in 2009, and then PSC approved. We've already paid a 5% surcharge, and once the plant's online, the PSC has said Georgia Power can get the cost back by charging you an additional.
Now there are two caveats here. I mean, number one is the resolution that was passed pointed out that if Congress does not extend the $800 million in tax credits expire, I think, in 2020 before either of these reactors are now scheduled to go online, then they may revisit the deal and they may pull the plug.
Buddy?
This might surprise you, but I believe that Plant Vogtle ought to be built if it's entirely possible, because the idea of just walking away from this kind of investment is very troubling to me. I was disappointed that Senator Isaacson was unable to get the $23 million in tax credits in this tax bill, and maybe he should have held out a little bit longer before going along with it. But being on the Senate Finance Committee, perhaps he can get those tax credits enacted in the early part of the upcoming year. But if those tax credits are not approved by the Congress of the United States, I think the deal is off. Is that right, Jim?
Yes, that's right. That's what the PSC said. It's $800 million total. It applied to anybody who had a nuclear power plant completed by 2020. Georgia Power's intention was to meet that deadline. They didn't, and so that $800 million has to be approved again. To move forward.
Yeah, we should note that it applies to any nuclear construction underway right now, but there is only one place where nuclear construction is underway
The idea of walking away from this kind of investment is very, very reckless in my view. And so I think at least the process has been out in the open, and we'll just see what
goes. And we can compliment Chuck Eaton and Tim Echols for actually being pretty straightforward about the pluses and minuses of this, which there are many on both sides.
I thought it was very interesting, the political reaction that came immediately after this vote yesterday. We heard from pretty much every candidate for governor, Republican and Democrat. You had on the Republican side, you had Michael Williams, refer to Vogtle as plant cronyism. You had Clay Tippins note that the PSC is too cozy with Georgia Power. On the Democratic side, you had Stacey Evans call for the end of the early payments by ratepayers, and Stacey Abrams saying the same thing. But not a single candidate endorsed walking away from that deal, walking away from the reactors. Not one.
And we have to broaden. We have to broaden our ideas. And I loved hearing Tim Echols saying, "Yes, we want to see some solar power in the future of Georgia. That has to happen." And then we've got to get back to a foundational basis of, look, you know, when do we depend on the market to bring these solutions? And it looks to me that there is some room to discuss whether or not we're allowing the market to bring power solutions to Georgia, or are we choosing a winner?
So this is complicated stuff. I always find personally PSC hearings to be stultifying. I can't make heads or tails of them. And so I suspect that as we dig into this, I mean, I'm hopeful that what we're doing now is helping, as we did the other day. I hope our listeners understand what the context of this is. But, buddy, it does matter to customers. They are going to pay. They're paying something like $100 a year more already on their power bills, not just Georgia Power customers, but EMCs who buy their power from Georgia Power. So it affects Georgians across the state.
Also, MEAG. I, of course, get my power from the Marietta Power, the Board of Lights and Water there, and, of course, they're also a part of the project as well.
There was one little line in that resolution that they passed yesterday that I thought was very, very interesting. Bill, you said that the average customer is paying about $100 extra a year for Vogtle, and that's true. And they've got a little codicil in there that is going to require Georgia Power to give refunds three times. Of $25 a piece, a total of $75.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And those refunds have to come by the end of the third quarter,
Wait, Jim, what else is happening around that time next year?
Why, we are going to have a general election in Georgia in which two members of the Public Service Commission are going to be up for re-election.
Wait a minute. I got to tell you, look, excuse me. $75 is $75. I would love to have an additional $75 in my pocket, but I don't think my vote for a PSC commissioner can be bought for $75.
It's the language that goes on the bill. They've required the language on the bill to say Vogtle settlement refund.
One thing the Democrats are doing this time is we're going to have some contested PSC elections, not mm-hmm. only in our primary, but also there will be a candidate for the two contested public service.
Lindy Miller.
Yes.
And I think John Knoll.
We need more attention on the PSC.
That's what I was kind of hinting at. Their matters are complicated, hard for us, people like me, to grasp. But what they do has enormous impact on us as residents of the state of Georgia. All right, I got to get a break in. When we come back, there's another tax being proposed for citizens of Georgia that will hit you right in your Stranger Things. This is Political Rewind.
I'm Robin Young. When news breaks hundreds of miles away, we turn to those who know the community best.
Vanessa Rancagno of member station KQED.
He is a reporter with member station WRTU in San Juan.
And as Houston Public Media's Gail DeLotta reports.
Let's talk about this with Casey Morrell, who's a producer with KNPR. He's in Las Vegas.
Wherever the news breaks in 2018, we'll be there. Be here for us by making a year-end gift.
Go to gpb.org and click donate. And thanks.
Thanks for joining us here on GPB, an 18-station service of Georgia Public Broadcasting. All things considered and Marketplace still to come this afternoon. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, the largest university in Georgia and one of the largest in the nation.
Joining me in the Political Rewind studio, former Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden, now a partner with Dentons, the world's largest, and this is not Trumpian rhetoric, the world's largest law firm. Wow, Buddy.
Yes, but not the largest salary.
Oh, okay. Leo Smith, Republican strategist. He ran for state Senate in this last special election cycle, and he is now back with us, and we're glad he is. And Jim Galloway, my partner from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, joins me. Jim, so I said, I mentioned Stranger Things, which I think most people know is one of the most successful series that Netflix has ever dumped on the public. And I mention it because there is now a proposal, we'll see how it develops throughout the session, right, to tax us for telephones, for possibly streaming services, right, like Netflix, and And for, I'll think of it. But tell me what you want. We're going to say about it, and then I'll come back and you know,
right.
tell you what
all
else.
All right.
Is
basically,
involved.
What this Satelli- is.
Satellites? Okay. Go mm-hmm. ahead.
All right. Okay. The House Rural Development Council issued its report this on Monday. Basically, this is David Ralston's. We had him on the show a week or so ago talking about this. But there is a concerted effort to really concentrate on the economic situation in rural Georgia, which is quite dire. And one of the foundational proposals that they're making is that they've got to get broadband access into the deepest corners of the state if they're ever going to be able to do anything about increasing health care, in propping up education in those areas. And to do that, this is one way that they're contemplating on financing, pushing the broadband out there, and that is to tax the people who already have it, and so it can be spread elsewhere.
It'll never fly. It's a waste of time, and what they ought to do, in my view, is to work with the utility companies, such as the EMCs and the people who serve these outlying areas, and come up with a formula to do it through the private sector. I don't think that the government can solve every single problem, economic problem we have, and I think you're going to have a tremendous amount of resentment, and I'll predict
and,
right
and,
here.
And Buddy
is sounding like a free market guy.
And
I love
it's
this.
It is also an election year.
Yeah, what a time. Okay, first of all, let me go back because I botched that. It is phone services. It is also perhaps streaming services like Netflix and Amazon. What I really left out is TV subscriptions. So if you have if you're a Comcast customer, you might pay an additional tax, I assume that means, on your cable bill. And yes, what is going on, Leo Smith, that apparently Republicans are going to float this proposal to raise our taxes in an election year?
Well, there's a couple of Republicans that are going to put it there. And I think the way that they're going to broach it is that they just want to make this issue an issue of how Georgia is trying to develop our rural, our 16% of Georgia's economy, which is the rural Georgia, and how to get that area. I mean, we're also talking about how to encourage people to move to rural areas.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a minute, as a matter of fact.
But what Congressman Darden is speaking of is very important, and that is, if the state tries to create the solution, it disincentivizes the market to create the solution. And it, even in places like the desert of Africa, you have companies now creating wireless internet services from satellite, et cetera, that can be used for
military.
The market will respond.
All right, but Leo, let me ask Buddy to respond. Let me put it to you, Buddy. What Leo just said sounds like a free market solution, but the free market hasn't helped build wireless in South Georgia. How do you encourage that? It's not happening.
Well, of course, the technology continues to improve, but I'm always reminded when you start talking about getting people to move to rural areas and doing things for rural areas, is the reason that people are in these urban areas is because of the advantages that are given by a more populated area. I know we'll forget talking to the late Dr. Hamilton Holmes one time when he was on a panel with me talking about doctors and why didn't people want to go out to the rural areas. And he says, I didn't make the sacrifices I made in going to college and medical school and working hard as I can, just where I could go out and deprive my sons and daughters of the advantages of living in Atlanta.
But,
and so that's typical
right,
everywhere.
But Bill, there's the one thing that Georgia has not done and other states have done is we are shifting toward, of course, an internet economy. And the state of Georgia has not yet grappled with how that changes the taxing structure that we all depend on for state services. We're not, for right now, you're likely to see when the legislature comes back, you're probably going to see another effort to make sure that goods purchased on the internet by Georgia residents and delivered to Georgia are subject to a tighter sales tax. This is an area that the live streaming is something that Georgia doesn't tax right now, and
right.
as the more of the economy moves into that area, there's going to be some argument that this is the responsible thing to do.
All right. We'll watch how that develops. But meanwhile, Jim, in terms of this whole notion of the legislature finding ways to encourage people to move to South Georgia, you have a column coming up on Sunday in which you talk about this quite extensively. And we don't want to give away all of it, but you had a remarkable figure in here about the populations of Georgia counties that have been reduced compared to what they were at some point.
Oh, right, right, right. 124 of Georgia's 159 counties have fewer people in them now than they did in 1860 when cotton and slavery were at their height.
Wow.
I mean, and that's it's largely a swath of South Georgia. And if you go through that territory, if you drive through that territory now, you will see ghost towns. And this is what the other part of this rural development council list of solutions that they've got going is a program to pay people to relocate into South Georgia.
Yeah, it was in the late 80s and early 90s, perhaps even before then, that the old Bell South and then Southern Bell before them actually had a plan to connect the whole state in a unified way, which would have led to this, but the Public Service Commission at that time rejected it. And this was very forward thinking at least 30 years ago. And it's hard to see if that would be accomplished today if it wasn't accomplished back
then.
Well,
you know, one of the biggest reasons people move to urban areas are for services and things like affordable housing. And perhaps then part of that discussion ought to be whether or not you should develop better schools in some of these rural towns and affordable housing in this town. And certainly that would, I think, attract people to those.
Well,
areas.
And of course, they have looked at issues like that. For instance, the speaker, when he was here, pointed out that part of that study has been looking at health services.
Right, and that gets you back to the broadband issue.
Exactly. So, all right, we're going to watch how that
But there's one thing, just very quickly, is what we have seen in terms of economic development most recently is that relocating companies are chasing, it's all technology oriented, and they're chasing millennials, and they're going where the millennials are. And we've talked time and again about the emphasis on things like transit and density. All of that stuff spells trouble, more trouble for South
for
Georgia.
For rural communities. Right, right. So, I mean, you have to commend the legislature for wanting to find creative solutions to that very problem.
And notice, notice there's a balance. The House is considering a means of how the state wants to participate in extending commuter rail throughout Metro Atlanta. And if they're going to pass that, they've got to give something to rural Georgia.
Yeah.
I think the PSC, the Public Service Commission, ought to bring these people in, and they could accomplish through the regulatory scheme how to carry this out without having to pass a law and tax
all right.
everybody.
I got to move us on. I want to get our second and final break of the show out of the way, because when we come back, I really want to talk with you all on the panel about the vote in the United Nations yesterday to condemn the United States by an overwhelming margin for the Trump decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The vote itself is interesting, but the U.S. reaction to it even more so. This is Political Rewind.
As you take time to give to the organizations that matter to you at this time of year, please remember that listener support powers everything you hear on GPB. Worldwide and statewide news, long-form interviews, and stories that connect us with each other. There's still time to make a tax-deductible year-end gift. Please take a moment now to go to gpb.org and click the donate button at the top of the page. From all of us at GPB, thank you for your support and happy holidays.
When U.S. service members lose their lives overseas, their death is followed by an elaborate, choreographed ritual that's largely shielded from the general public. For one Army sergeant, this has been his life's work.
You're bringing closure to families and you're bringing folks home.
I'm Ari Shapiro, our profile of a military mortician this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
4 till 7 here on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, Leo Smith, and Buddy Darden in the studio with us. So yesterday, the General Assembly of the United Nations voted to condemn the United States for President Trump's decision to change 80 years of international policy, which was to leave the status of Jerusalem undecided while the Palestinians and the Israelis played out their differences over how to achieve some form of peaceful settlement that would allow them to live in that, occupy that land together. Trump says, no, we're going to recognize Jerusalem as the capital. We're going to move the embassy there within 2 years. The UN condemned that. And after the vote, here's our ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley.
The United States is by far the single largest contributor to the United Nations and its agencies. When we make generous contributions to the UN, we also have a legitimate expectation that our goodwill is recognized and respected. When a nation is singled out for attack in this organization, that nation is disrespected. What's more, that nation is asked to pay for the privilege of being disrespected. In the case of the United States, we are asked to pay more than anyone else for that dubious privilege. We have an obligation to demand more for our investment.
Leo, what Nikki Haley said yesterday is, if you don't vote with us, we don't know that we really want to be part of this organization. It's your obligation to vote with us because of who we are as a generous people. That's strange logic to me.
Well, it's the logic of, if you want my protection, then you have to invest in me being strong.
Okay. And in other words, so the UN should be there as a rubber stamp for whatever the United States decides to do.
Not a rubber stamp, but strengthening Israel is strengthening an American ally. And therefore, you should be concerned about our welfare and our ability to keep investing in the Middle East and make it safer.
So, buddy, I hear what Leo Smith is saying, but there are an awful lot of people who think that by making this decision, this does not strengthen Israel. It, in fact, puts Israel in potentially more vulnerable position, not only because of world opinion, but because it keeps the Palestinians maybe less willing to negotiate with the Israelis. What do you say?
That is the prevailing attitude, because the United States is no longer an honest broker when it makes decisions like this that are so totally one side to Israel, that what we do is we lose our credibility in the world. But the statement you heard from Nikki Haley was from the Secretary of State in waiting, because she has articulated the Trump philosophy so well that it's just a matter of time before she moves over to Foggy Bottom.
Jim,
a really good point.
That is a good point, but it's interesting because because I think a lot of people have looked at Nikki Haley and thought of her as being a moderate in the Trump administration, as not someone who has jumped to his defense at every moment.
She's moved very, very much to the to the right on this one. This is the disruption of 70 years of U.S. policy, and the U.S. has always insisted that the status of Jerusalem be one of the last things decided when Palestine and Israel create their two separate states. And what this is, what this move is a recognition, or it's a move away from a two-state solution in that area. And you had the groups the countries voting against the U.S. on this were some of their best friends. United Kingdom, Germany,
yeah.
France, Japan,
India.
The votes and
Afghanistan.
Now Nikki Haley has issued invitations for a friendship party for next month to celebrate the people who voted with the U.S. Against this resolution, and that's Tojo, Micronesia. I can't read my
what
own
about
writing.
Turkey?
Palau, the Marshall Islands, and Guatemala.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned Turkey, Jim Galloway. Buddy Darden, because let's listen. The foreign minister of Turkey took the well at the UN yesterday after Nikki Haley's comments and after the lobbying that the U.S. delegation did before the vote. And this is what he said.
It is unethical to think that the rights and dignity of member states are for sale. Let me put it in this way. We will not be intimidated. You can be strong, but this doesn't make you right.
So, buddy, regardless of how you feel about the best way to resolve a peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, it does strike me that the decision to get so tough in the response to this vote furthers our concerns, our questions about how much the United States is willing to go it alone in the world. They are going to need many of the countries in the UN that we are as Americans to work with us on crucial issues moving forward, and this is an isolating tactic.
Bill, when I was in Congress, we used to always meet with AIPAC and the Jewish lobby and get what their priorities were, and they would tell us how they felt about this issue and all other issues, and this would be the last ranking issue. And they said, just to satisfy our right wing, we put this on our list, but we really don't believe that this is necessary to carry out our friendship and our relationship with Israel. So I think this is going entirely too far and removes us. It removes us as an honest broker and also puts us in a situation of going it alone.
But it perhaps also removes us from responsibility for funding the defense of many nations. And so in a way, if we are isolating ourselves, we're also isolating ourselves from sharing in the expense of protecting countries by our taxpayers' expense.
Okay, you're advocating that.
Well, collective security, however, is always in the best interest of the United States. The reason we support NATO is because we'd rather them fight over there than over here.
Sure.
And we have always supported countries and their defense only when it was in our own national security interest.
All right.
But
right.
World's too big for us to go along.
Right. This is a negotiating tactic, I think, on Trump's part.
All right. Well, we'll see it play out. I want to move to a subject that brings us back closer to home. Jim Galloway, this seemed to be an ingenious solution to a problem that some of the cities in Georgia may want to try to figure out. Tennessee has a statute, much like Georgia's, which forbids cities, municipalities, from doing anything to remove change.
Hide or
whatever Confederate markers that are on public land. So Tennessee has that statute. We know that there are people in Georgia concerned about that right now, and we're going to see it come up in the legislature. But the city of Memphis has a couple of statutes, including one of Nathan Bedford Forrest, perhaps one of the most controversial Confederate officers. This is a guy who founded the KKK, is accused of having planned the massacre of African-American Union troops after they were captured. So it was on public land, this statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest. What did Memphis do?
Well, they sold it to a 501c3, the land to a 501c3 organization.
For like $1,000, I think.
Two plots of land for, I mean, I can't remember whether it was $1,000 each or just a total $1,000. The deed transfer was made, and the statues disappeared within hours. If I can emphasize exactly
sure.
what just the situation in Memphis. Number one, Memphis is like Atlanta, politically controlled by African Americans. Nathan Bedford Forrest was the originator of the KKK, in the Reconstruction period. Fort Pillow, which is where the massacre that you spoke of, is very, very close to Memphis. So all of this is, you can see history rubbing up against the situation here, and we've had reporters, the AJC's had reporters call lawyers here. They've compared the statutes. They say Georgia's is a little bit more tightly drafted. That tactic probably wouldn't work here.
And in fact, we're not even sure it's going to play out in Tennessee. I mean, the state legislature there, apparently they're already fuming about this and looking for remedies of this.
Leo, where are you? Okay, all right. When Roy Moore was defeated, you kind of weighed in on this topic in a little bit.
Well, I did, in the sense that, look, it's another nuanced issue. I think that we should tell more history. I think that we should look for ways to create the free flow of these histories into museums. But I don't think that we should have a carte blanche go out and pull down the statue. So when a private citizen decides to fund a foundation to preserve Confederate history, I'm quite okay with that. In the same way, if someone says, I'm going to buy this land so that I can get rid of it, that's the free market taking having an impact on social
justice.
Buddy,
I'm going to give you one word on this.
Let me agree with Leo here, because I believe that people of goodwill and people who are conscientious about doing the right thing can come to reasonable solutions here. Look what we did in Hancock County, Georgia. Our square started off as solely a Confederate memorial, but it's been transitioned without fanfare into a veterans memorial, honoring veterans from everywhere in all wars. And it's time to do some common sense, reasonable people solutions.
All right. Well, we'll see, because it's no question the legislature is going to be asked to deal with this in some way. All right, Buddy Darden, I want to walk through a little bit of recent history that I think will be fun for you especially. This morning, I was thinking about this race in the Virginia House of Delegates that we've been all hearing a lot about. Was won at first, it appeared, by a Democrat by one vote. Then there was a second recount. It now appears perhaps the Republican won it, got the an additional vote to tie it up, which means a coin toss eventually will determine who is in that seat by state law in Virginia, and that'll determine whether Republicans still have control of the assembly up there. But here's why I thought about it, Buddy. I went looking to see about other close races like that one, any other one-vote races, and I didn't find those. But I did come across the race in which Democrat Frank McCloskey in Indiana was in a race against a Republican in which four votes separated the two.
That's right. His name was Rick McIntyre.
The Republican. There were two recounts, which, for whatever reason, I'm not sure, didn't quite determine the outcome, and it was thrown to Leon Panetta, who was a member of the Democrats. You were in control. You were in that Congress.
That I was in that control, and as you know, the arbiter of final selection on matters of this nature is up to the body of the House of Representatives, and after hearings and counts and recounts, it was determined that Frank McCloskey was the winner, and the full House of Representatives, after hearings and vote counts and so forth, did in fact ratify the election of Frank McCloskey, and I think he served several terms.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Actually, I went to a new member's orientation with McIntyre, and he had already been proclaimed the winner and certified by the Secretary of State of Indiana, but of course that was changed, and Frank McCloskey came on.
Okay, so the Democratic House appointed a then-Congressman Leon Panetta to lead that recount. But then something else interesting happened. The minority leader, the Republican minority leader, was Michaels.
Bob Michaels.
Bob Michaels. And Michaels, apparently, when McCloskey came into the chamber the first, greeted him warmly, glad we can work with you, congratulations on this close win. And here's why I bring all of this up, really. Because it was this event that biographers of Newt Gingrich say was the one that triggered his decision that he was not only going to fight against Democrats, he thought the whole thing was a corrupt enterprise. He was appalled by the way in which Bob Michaels gave in on this, greeted McCloskey so warmly. And Time Magazine has a big piece on the history of Newt Gingrich, which says that's when he decided he was going to end up leading the Republican revolution that led to the takeover in 94.
Well, that's what he says. However, I think he's also cited some other instances which also led him to that decision. But certainly I do remember there was a good bit of rancor over the McCloskey event.
Leo? It's a fascinating scenario.
It's very fascinating, and it kind of reminds me of this idea of being able to influence the new congressman from Alabama to kind of hold his position. I mean, what's happening here now, this thing is so nuanced that, you know, me being in minority voter engagement is one of my areas of expertise, but when you have such slim margins and you see different voting blocks having such an impact, it's time to relook at how we talk about politics.
You're talking about Senator Doug Jones. I've asked that question on this show. I think I don't think I've asked you, Galloway, but I do wonder if Doug Jones, when he gets to the Senate, can be will be a reliable Democratic vote, he's going to have to stand for re-election in Alabama. And it strikes me he's going to be looking over his shoulder at what is still a reliably red state, were it not for a crazy candidate like Roy Moore.
Well, this we get back to the Stacey Evans or Stacey Abrams decision.
Yeah.
Do you go toward the middle, or do you pay more attention to your base voters?
I think what you do is you remember, of course, that you're a member of the Democratic caucus, but on issues of substance, not procedure, not organization, but when it comes to issues of substance, then you have and should get a little more understanding from leadership when those issues come up. But he is elected as a Democrat. He will be a member of the Democratic caucus, and he'll be expected to vote on certain party-line issues, such as the majority leader, in fact, on that.
All right. We've had a long week. Buddy, did you want to add something?
Are we going to talk about some of the people that we lost over the years?
I'll tell you what. Why don't you go ahead and take we're running short. Who would you like to remember?
I'd like to remember two people. One, of course, Tommy Irvin, Commissioner of Agriculture for many, many years, and a great force in Georgia politically. He was executive secretary to Lester Maddox. He served in the Georgia House. He was appointed to be Commissioner of Agriculture and served until his retirement almost 40 years later. And one other that we haven't mentioned, former Congressman Dawson Mathis, who served as a great character from the 2nd District, served with distinction and great honor in that area.
We also lost somebody who was not known to the public as much as he was to those of us who spend a lot of time dealing with folks at the state cap, Frank Bates.
Absolutely. Frank was from Tolliver County, Georgia, and a very personable and warm and very valuable to the Zell Miller organization.
He'd been involved in the civil rights movement. That's what brought him to Zell Miller eventually. And as Buddy points out, he was extremely valuable in helping Zell Miller understand the African American coalition he needed.
Right, He died. I think this summer, and that was one of. Zell goes to funeral.
Yeah.
Zell Miller always goes to funerals for people who were loyal to him.
And he
didn't show up, and that kind of
told you some stuff about Zell's health.
Speak across the nation about these histories, these American histories, those are stories that we don't know about. Those people who, you know, were the first ones in the battle and put cracks in the wall, and now we knock at the wall and it falls down. But those people's stories need to be told.
Leo Smith, you get the last word. On the last live show that we're doing on Political Rewind in 2017, Leo, thank you, Buddy Darden, and Jim Galloway. We are, if you're listening to us in real time, this is our final live show. We're not on the air on Christmas Day. And then Wednesday, we're going to share with you a show we recorded with Keyser Khan, who gave that convention speech on behalf of Hillary Clinton that electrified the nation, angered Trump supporters, made Democrats very happy. That's Wednesday. And Friday, we've got a year-end show. Our take on what the biggest stories were in Georgia and across the country. In the meantime, I wish all of you a very Merry Christmas. We'll see you again after the new year. By the way, enjoy the start to the new year, too. Bye-bye.